Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Diana Mackay, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's interesting when we take a look at Canadian post-secondary education. How do we define what it is and what its role is in our national strategy around matching education needs with those of the labor force for now and into the future?
You know, you said a couple of very interesting things there, defining it and how it connects with the strategy. So on the definition, you know, it was a lot easier to define post-secondary education before the digital age, I think, because you had a very logical progression of early childhood education through primary, secondary, and then on to post-secondary. Now that there's a capacity for institutions and learners to access information and knowledge anytime they want, anywhere they want, in any depth they want, it may be harder to define post-secondary education going forward because people can access that information more readily.
But does that present challenges or opportunities?
Well, I think it invites us to rethink a little bit the structures, the investments, the way we organize ourselves around universities and colleges in particular. We've had for many years the environment where students finish high school, they are 18 years of age, and then they go into a university or a college and spend 4 years there. And these are four really important years because you're very healthy, you are creative, you're thinking about your future, and to take four prime years of life and not earn an income and instead spend money and time in a program, that's something I think increasingly we're going to see young people challenge.
Well, because they're looking for a return on that investment, aren't they?
Well, they'll get a return on the investment no matter what because, no matter how you look at it, it's a good investment to get more education. Mm-hmm. It always pays off.
But does it not need to be aligned with some kind of national strategy? And do we have a national strategy as far as post-secondary is concerned?
Well, we don't necessarily, I think, have a national strategy. It's very difficult in Canada to have a national strategy because our constitution states that education is a provincially mandated area.
Yeah.
So we have, you could argue, 23 or 24 strategies because we have at least 10 provincial ministries of education plus at least 10 provincial ministries of post-secondary or advanced education plus territorial departments of education. And you even have, in some provinces, ministries that have an educational element to them, like a skills ministry or an innovation ministry. So it's hard to convene ministers to talk about their plans. And it's, to date, been impossible to put together something that looks like a national strategy for Canada, but we should have one.
So without it, though, what are we missing out on?
Well, we're missing out on what other countries are able to do in the way of marrying up the national agenda they have with the machinery of their post-secondary system.
Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah, a really good example was a few years ago when Brazil, experiencing rapid growth, decided to have a program whereby they would send fully funded graduate students to a number of countries around the world to gain a deep experience in post-secondary environment and then, in theory, either come back home to Brazil to help fuel the Brazil economy on development and innovation and so on and so forth and business enterprise, or even for those Brazilian students that were fully funded by the Brazilian government, should they choose to stay away, still pretty good for Brazil. They create networks.
Yeah.
They drive business back home to their home country. They act as leaders in global settings to help Brazil reach new markets or engage in new partnerships. So it's pretty good strategy no matter what. And that's an example of where Brazil was able to put together fairly quickly a bit of a game plan for what they would like to do and execute on it. In Canada, we struggle to put together that game plan and execute on it in an efficient way because we're dealing with so many different players and the absence of a national game plan.
So if we take a look at what we have, even though it's disconnected in some ways, there is still an interconnection. These institutions talk to one another. There is something here. Canadian education is not something to be taken lightly. We've got a pretty good reputation, do we not?
We do. Yeah. We do. We've got a good system. I hesitate to say we have a great system because we're a a medium power, I would say, a medium to top power. We're, you know, always on the cusp of the great educational players in the globe.
Mm-hmm.
We have uniformly high quality institutions across Canada that all receive strong funding. That's mm-hmm. a proudly public system. We are absent a private system of education at post-secondary level in Canada. There's, you know, one, maybe you could find a few other small players. But we don't have much in the way of sort of peaks of performance. You know, we are, mm-hmm. our system is uniformly across the board strong.
We're good, but we're not
great. We're struggling to be, you know, doing things quickly and with a nimbleness that many other countries can do.
So there's a number of things in what you've just talked about. Number one is, let's deal with the number of Chinese students who are coming to Canada for an education. How important to that is it in the overall funding mix that we have in Canada to being able to maintain the quality of education that we have?
Books are written on that. And you can find opposing points of view about whether the international students are actually funding Canadian schools or not. Some will tell you fairly coherently and compellingly that we're dependent on the international students paying international student fees, and that's mm-hmm. very much helping our institutions. And you
well,
can find
Andrew
others.
Petter, the president of SFU, would agree with that.
Yeah. There's others that will say if you add in all the costs associated with educating the international students, it's actually a break-even scenario, or sometimes it costs us a little bit too.
Because there are other societal costs that are wrapped into all of that. And,
or there's other costs even inside the institutions themselves. So it's a pretty interesting debate. What we have to be mindful of, though, is what kind of an impact the clusters are having on the system. So the Chinese cluster is a big cluster.
Mm-hmm.
That changes sometimes some dynamics that are important for us to pay attention to. Simply as an example, dynamics in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a classroom that is dominated by students from China, there can be both good impacts of that and impacts that we want to be careful don't turn into a negative effect for domestic students.
Is there not a long-term benefit to Canada if we're bringing international students here to learn? Do we not then start to create those networks that as those people move through the course of their lives and careers, mm-hmm. they now have a connection to Canada?
Yeah. It's a terrific strategy for all those other countries around the world to be sending their kids to Canada for school.
Right.
No doubt about it.
Well, for them to send it to us, but what's in it for us?
Well, we should be sending our young people away a little bit more than we are. So if you look at the balance, we have something on the order of 2% of domestic students are having a meaningful international experience as part of their post-secondary
2%.
Education. 2%.
Wow, it's not very high at all.
It's not very high at all. So one of the things I think we ought to be thinking carefully about is why aren't our domestic students going away in the numbers that the other countries are sending their domestic students away?
Are you able to answer that question?
Well, I think there's some number of factors. I think one of them is that we don't do a very good job of telling the young people in Canada why they should be going away,
mm-hmm.
And also where they should be going. We let them often drive the decisions on that one, and you'll find that those students that do tend to go away go to very lovely places like the south of France, mm-hmm. Where there's terrific educational opportunities for them, no doubt, and also to the United States, again, terrific educational opportunities. Very few would go to the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Very few go to parts of Asia where Canada has a very important trade relationship, for example. Likewise, very few would go to parts of Latin America. We probably want to encourage young people to take a look at the places that they can go and where that will lead them in terms of the future and their own careers.
So how do we make that happen, though? Because there is a financial component to that argument.
Yeah.
And as a parent, you go, well, that's a nice idea, but who's going to pay for it?
Yeah, well, it isn't necessarily all that expensive. That might be a bit of a myth.
Uh-huh. But you can see why the question would rise.
Yeah, this comes back to let's get some good information circulating. Mm-hmm. Many countries around the world now have terrific scholarships that they will offer to inward-bound international students. So, for example, right now, Japan, a country where they've got a declining population, low immigration, and the 2020 Olympics coming up. An image issue. So they have recently announced that they will be investing big time in their post-secondary system, including financing scholarships for international students who want to spend time at a Japanese institution, to the order of some scholarships are $1,000 a month. So it's not small change. big opportunities. Yeah. And we in Canada probably need to be telling our young people a little bit more about where these opportunities are and how they go about them. And also that the return on the investment for them is magnificent. And if I can give you just a personal example, one that is hard to believe, but I did my own international exchange 30 years ago in Japan. And it was expensive to go. But within 2.5 years of working after I finished my degree, I went back to Japan to work. Within 2.5 years, I saved enough money to go to graduate school. I fully financed my graduate school. You can save money. You actually, you know, it's not impossible to imagine.
Yeah.
You will get a really good job if you have these kinds of experiences. And not only will you be able to get good jobs when you graduate, because now more than ever, a global experience is a big plus in an employer's mind. But also, you will be more attractive to graduate schools.
Mm-hmm.
So you will actually probably be able to get into some pretty terrific places.
And you wouldn't otherwise be eligible to.
You wouldn't otherwise be able to get into.
So you've taken me in a little bit of a different direction here from where I thought we were maybe going to go, because I thought maybe we were going to say, yes, what we need to be doing is selling the Canadian educational experience internationally and doing it in a variety of different ways. Mm-hmm. You're saying, yeah, but we also need to go get that international experience ourselves.
Sure. Mm-hmm. We can sell what we've got a little bit more too, and we should definitely sell it more to non-traditional students.
Mm-hmm.
We've got loads and loads of international students coming to Canada for our universities and colleges. I think the numbers were something on the order of 245,000 international students in Canada at any given time, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And the goal is to up that number to about 450,000 international students by 2020. What happens if we were to package up the expertise of our universities and colleges and start selling it to audiences around the world in the business sector?
So how are you suggesting doing that?
Online satellite campuses and having them come here too.
Mm-hmm.
Having them come to our campuses and our terrific, you know, Canada is a very attractive place for people to spend a few years of their lives. Have them come here, live here, fuel our economy by being part of the Canadian system and so on, and get a professional program or a chance to practice their skills, apply their skills using their deep knowledge of some field and conducting their business in English, learning how to,
mm-hmm.
to you know, again, with the language of commerce being English, there's untold demand around the world for people to come and sort of gain their fluency in English through an experience here. We could do much more of that.
I note that Harvard, MIT, Berkeley, and a number of other of the top-tier schools in the United States are involved in the edX online programs, the MOOCs that they're offering.
Yeah.
How are we doing in Canada as far as getting in on that wave of digital distribution?
We're doing pretty well, I think. We've got some universities. I don't know as much about the college's participation in MOOCs. It's mostly a university environment.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been some flagship MOOCs that have been offered by Canadian institutions. They mm-hmm. are not inexpensive to do well. And
no,
the payoff
because production
is,
values matter.
Yeah, and, the payoff you have to see in terms of reputational gain as opposed to student fees, because, of course, there are no student fees in a MOOC. But I'd say all universities in Canada are starting to get very creative in terms of teaching and learning pedagogy online.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see more and more investments in that area and more delivery of courses, even for our students that are domestic and are coming to our campuses daily, more and more of the content is being delivered online. And that's what the students want. It's what
mm-hmm.
they're comfortable with. It opens up the doors to knowledge to a lot of people who can't get to the classroom. And that's terrific, I think.
Your job now is focusing in on just this. Why did Carleton identify that this is such an important element within the overall structure of the university?
Well, I think Carleton saw a huge opportunity in that it's a capital city university.
Mm-hmm.
And there are signals from the provincial governments that innovation in terms of pedagogy, in terms of program design, in terms of thinking outside the box would be welcome. And so this global academy that I'm establishing is trying to sort of carve new ground for Carleton to open up what we do here to the world and bring the world to the capital city here in Ottawa of Canada and take advantage of the opportunities that we can offer.
How long have you been doing it now?
Just over a year.
And how's it going?
It's an interesting enterprise. You know, it is actually an enterprise if you think of it inside of a university.
So does it become like a revenue-generating center within the university?
Yeah.
So how do you go about creating that? Because you're making it up. because it didn't exist before.
Yeah, it's a bit of a blend of you can think of it as packaging up bits and pieces of the faculty, the faculties, the departments, or the individual faculty members, and putting them into a format that would be attractive for sale on the open market. And you can imagine the conversations I have internally on those kinds of matters.
Okay, that sounds like it's a marketing strategy, but it must be more than that. There must be systemic or system-related issues that you need to address to be able to make that happen.
For sure. And this is not an issue that I'm facing alone. All across Canada and all around the world, you can see academia sort of being challenged to think differently and to do differently and to take a system that is designed for a purpose that is educational and apply it in a more business-like way to the world that is, you know, rapidly changing and rapidly calling us to do things differently and to be more nimble and respond to demand. You know, you get this whole conversation in Canada around skills and what the labor market needs and what the university system and the college system is providing in terms of graduates. So there's lots of pressures on the system right now, and I'm right in the middle of all of it and trying to figure it all out.
So when you take a look at what the opportunities are for you to be able to present that, what is the most effective or attractive strategy at this point for you to say, this is going to become our priority, and then we're going to follow up in the following ways?
Well, I think for me right now, it's a bit of a experimental approach, where on the one hand, I do know a few countries fairly well. I've done some work on international education in Germany, in India, in the UK, in Japan, of course, and China. Identifying what their points of pain are in those countries and how we can kind of respond to their points of pain is one strategic approach that I'm taking.
And it's an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah.
We tried that and ouch, it didn't work quite so well.
Well, yeah. Or if you hit their point of pain with a solution,
yes,
then they chances are they'll buy it.
Ah, okay. You're right? Looking at being able to solve challenges or problems that they have.
Yeah. So, I could give you a few examples there where, again, coming back to China, for example, where universities are increasingly being called on to teach their programs in English. Mm-hmm. If you're a management professor in China and you're looking to teach management in English for the first time, you may have decent English, but maybe you're not so confident that you can teach management in English effectively without a little bit of a practice. We'll come on over to Canada for a while. We'll give you some work-relevant language training. We'll put you in the classroom with management professors so you can see how it's done. Interestingly, you can...
So there's a teach-the-teacher component.
There's a teach-the-teacher component,
to
too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's also, Canada has a lot of diversity, and we have had a lot of experience with diversity. And so for other countries that are just beginning to experience this wave of diversification of the population, at least diversification of the student population, there's lots of lessons that can be learned from Canada's experience. So another thing I'm trying to do is package up expertise or certainly the array of experience that we've got in classrooms that are very diverse, and that's not just at the post-secondary level, but also even in the primary and secondary level.
So we talk about China, but the same issues must exist in India to a certain extent. Yeah. I know that English is far more embedded into the culture there, but the rapid changes and growth in post-secondary education in India must mean that it could be a fantastic opportunity for Canadian
institutions. I mean, if I'm not going to get the... India announced a few years ago that they were going to skill up 500 million people.
Yeah.
Okay? And they were calling on their education system to handle 350 million of them and the private sector to handle 150 million of them. So the numbers are staggeringly huge.
How do you do that?
Yeah, they needed to build new institutions, but they also, the 150 million that are being skilled up by the private sector is the part that really interests me. And I've been to some of the very, very large businesses that have very, very large campuses with large buildings that look like universities and in fact function very much like universities, where they're doing a lot of training of their future workers or They may not be their future workers. They just may be people that they're training for the purpose of fueling into the economy to run the businesses that, that they need in their supply chain, mm-hmm. and so on. So it's actually fascinating what's happening in India.
So we have some fantastic opportunities in Asia, both in India and in China. It must be an exciting time for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're just a small university here in the nation's capital.
Yeah. This is why we need a bit of a game plan, I think, because we've got so much to offer. Mm-hmm. And it's Canada's opportunity to take advantage of the vast opportunity around the world, not just in India, not just in China, but you could name a number of countries in around the Pacific. In fact, you could name the entire continent of Africa. There is a lot of work that could be done. And you could also, by the way, throw in Brexit mm-hmm. as a challenge facing the UK that will maybe deter from some clients of education from going to the UK. You mm-hmm. could look at what's happening in the States, and you could say Canada's opportunity again is manifest right now in a lot of potential students that would be looking where they're going to go and choosing between mm-hmm. Maybe not the United States, maybe Australia, maybe Canada.
So we discussed at the beginning of this conversation that there isn't a national strategy. You're doing this in Carleton. How important is it for you to be able to capitalize on this, to be able to do it in harmony with other of our larger post-secondary institutions in Canada?
Yeah, that would be, I think, terrific if we could do that. And we'd have to find some ways of working together that are calling on us to maybe redefine how we mm-hmm. organize ourselves.
So you're not in competition with one another.
You know, competition's not a bad thing. But I think sometimes cooperation is also needed.
Well, sure, because if you talk about 150 million students, let alone 500, where in Canada do we have the capacity to deal with something like that? And so you say, yeah, I'm going to go in and address some of that issue. Okay, we're going to give you 3 million students.
Right.
You don't have the capacity to deal with that.
I'd love to have that problem, though.
Yeah. Well, I wish you all the luck. Thank you for doing this.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Yeah.